meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com. It's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. I thought it particularly fitting with the sentencing of Orenthal James Simpson today to do the topic that we're going to do here in just a second or two. Now, I'm going to take a lot of flack for this, but it's okay. I've got three attorneys, very high-profile attorneys, and I have one DA, just to kind of even things out a little bit. It takes three attorneys to go after one DA anyway, and talk to them about how it is to have a client like an Orenthal James Simpson that you just can't win as far as the public goes. There's just no way. They're hated, and you've got to go to court and you've got to try a case and do the best you can. We've got Joel Brodsky here. Of course, you know Joel. He represents Drew Peterson. We've got Mark Garagos here. He represents Scott Peterson. And Joe Tacopina is here, who represents Joran Vandersloot and the Vandersloot family. And from Los Angeles County, Assistant District Attorney Robin Sachs. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Thank you for spending some time with us. Before we get started on specific questions to you as far as how you handle things, and if you're hearing a little bit of background noise, that's Mark Garagos is actually on an airplane, and I really appreciate him coming on. I want to ask you your thoughts on the O.J. Simpson sentencing today, and we'll start with Mark Garagos.
So I thought, obviously, it was expected. In fact, I think he got a little less than what everybody else expected. And clearly, he was up against it there. I mean, that was not a case that anyone, I think, would have thought that he stood much of a chance on just because of who he is. I mean, given the facts and circumstances of that case, there's a lot of times when you would expect that a case like that might not even get filed. But given who he is, he gets extra special attention.
Joe Tacopina, or O.J. Simpson and Joran Vandersloot, if I was to compare TV coverage of both, I would say that it's somewhat similar. Their TV is all over both of them. I'm curious your thoughts on the Simpson verdict today.
Well, the sentencing, today, not the verdict, but the sentencing, well, I agree with Mark. It was a little bit lower than I thought. I thought the judge was going to sentence O.J. Simpson for the robbery, the break-in robbery conviction in Las Vegas, and the one that got away in Los Angeles. So I was a little surprised at that 9 years because that was not the maximum sentence. So, I think this judge obviously, and by the way, the judge made a point to say repeatedly she's not sentencing O.J. Simpson for the actions that he was alleged to have committed out in L.A. that I think most normal people believe he did commit. So, yeah, I think I was surprised, quite frankly.
Joel Brodsky, hearing the judge, like Joe Tacopina just mentioned, go over and over that this isn't about 13 years ago, this is about today. Is that to avoid an appeal or to make sure all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed?
Well, I don't know that she can say it all she wants, but I don't know how you can really believe that's true. I think if it was anybody but O.J. Simpson who had committed the type of acts that he was accused of committing, if they even would have been charged, they would have been charged with as many heavy felonies as he was. I thought his right of elocution when he actually addressed the judge and apologized and explained his actions, I wonder if he would have been convicted on as many charges if the jury had heard those explanations. Now, Yael Galanter's a great attorney, and I don't want to second-guess somebody, in the field. But he sounded sincere to me, and I thought he got a really stiff sentence for a crime where there was no injury. Nobody's life was put at risk, and it was just basically a first offense property crime.
Robin Sachs, when you see the media reports on O.J. today, nobody can get it right. He's been sentenced to either 33 years, 6 years, 5 years, 15 years, 16 years. I've heard it all across the board, but I'm curious your perspective as a DA. This case is probably far from being over with the appellate process going, but it looks like O.J. is going to spend a little time in jail.
Yes, I'm. I was surprised at the verdict, and I haven't been very surprised at anything since. And actually, I wasn't surprised at the sentence because I think that from the judge's point of view, this was a serious enough crime where you have guns, you have weapons, you have a history, and you have all these other factors. And I thought it was kind of a middle of the road. Almost, it was enough to satisfy, you know, everyone's sense of justice, but certainly wasn't the max.
Left 53 service down to Burbank.
If
you can hear them calling to have the door closed. You know, it's an interesting thing, though. I mean, if Robin, I think, would tell you that in a case like this, I mean, this is normally something that you get maybe a year in county jail or low-term state prison at the most with no prior record. This is not with no shots fired. This is not the kind of case that somebody's going to get 9, 10, whatever high single digits. Just
Mark, I would agree with you if this was in Los Angeles County, but we have to remember that this is Vegas, and you know and I know that they are hardcore in Vegas on a lot of things that have nothing to do with O.J. Simpson. A dope case in Vegas gets time. You wouldn't get that here in Los Angeles necessarily. So it's hard to look at the Los Angeles as a barometer of what's reasonable. You know, compare this to Texas. Compare this to, I mean, that's what's interesting to me is in some ways just the fact that these charges were brought was something that I don't know would have happened here in Los Angeles. So it's hard when we look at our worldview from our courtrooms as to kind of the going rate of crime, but I don't know that this is so far-fetched from the going rate of crime in Las Vegas.
You know, when I announced...
From what I've heard, I mean, I don't practice there regularly, but I go there on occasion. I mean, yeah, they are hardcore. Usually, when you don't pay your gambling debts, then they issue a no bail warrant. But they've got their share of business there, and they don't like to overcrowd their jails too much.
You know, when I introduced the show or when I announced the show tonight, I got a lot of flack, and that's okay because I wanted to do this, and I want to go to Joe Tacopina here right now, as a way to sit down and talk about the system. Now, the system is the best system that we have. We have lawyers, defense lawyers, DAs, cops, everybody involved, justice, judges, you name it. And, we can complain about defense lawyers or we can complain about cops, and in my 26 years in law enforcement, I've gone to trials and testified, and I've walked away angry. But you know what? I'll sit down later with a defense lawyer, and I'll have a beer with him or her, and we'll talk about life because it's a system and it's a good one. Joe Tacopina, you've taken a lot of heat over the years as a defense lawyer. How do you handle something like this with as high profile clients as you've had and what you have right now?
You know, Dana, it's funny. I'm a recovering prosecutor. I was on the other side of the fence. I was, deputy chief of homicide in Brooklyn, New York, where there were plenty of those to go around. As a prosecutor, I never looked as a defense lawyer as part of the problem, but part of the system.
Yeah.
And I will tell you that having done some work out of our country's boundaries in Italy, involved in that case with Amanda Knox, the young girl from Seattle, who's being detained in Perugia, Italy, for over a year without being charged with a crime, it really sends a chill down your spine when you think about that. You know, we could all say, oh, the system's horrible and OJ and everything else, you know, but fact of the matter is it is by far and away the best system in the world. Most of the time, we get it right. And Danny, you know, I will tell you this. I do what I do in a very proud fashion because really, you know, we're guardians of the Constitution. And you know, it's very easy to presume someone guilty. I mean, believe me, but, you know, especially through your website there and
yep.
The Scared Monkey site and all that stuff. I mean, you know, look, I hear and heard what you know how strong a position you guys take. And look, that's great. Everyone's entitled to their opinion. I think we start becoming intellectually dishonest when we start saying, oh, defense lawyers are sleazy or monsters. I'm sure Robin wouldn't agree with that, because without them, there is no system.
That's right.
If you want to start being involved in a system of justice in our country where, you know, we chastise or shun people for standing up for the rights, the constitutional rights, and defending.
Right.
And I understand this. That does not mean that, you know, we as defense lawyers, our role is to get the guilty off. That's not our role at all. Our role is to challenge the proof and to make sure that the proof is there. And you know what? If after trial, there's a conviction and the proof is there, you know, we've done our jobs, the system has worked, Robin's done her job. If after trial there's an acquittal, even though the person may be guilty, that means there was a problem, an inherent problem with the proof, and that's the right verdict, because we don't want to start cutting corners with the ones we think are guilty, because the ones who then suffer, Dana, be sure, are the ones who are innocent. And I've represented way, way too many innocent people in my tenure as a defense lawyer, and that scares me. So I'm not ready to throw in the towel on our system by a long stretch.
I want to go to Joel Brodsky, representing Drew Peterson, and maybe after Joel responds, we can get Mark and Joe Tacopina to respond. You have a client who you give advice to, yet that client doesn't listen, and all of a sudden decides to take a polygraph test, or decides to go on a cable news show and start spouting nonsense, and then all of a sudden the whole world starts turning back on your client and the negativity starts, and you're pulling out whatever hair you've got left because your client isn't taking your advice, and this whole era of the media, the way it is now, the cable news shows and all that, it's difficult for them not to get involved and to turn the tables, so to speak. If we could start with Joel Brodsky and then go to Joe Tacopina and then Mark to respond, please.
Yeah, wow, what a great question. Yeah, what do you do with a client who is, innocent, and deserves a defense and a very vigorous defense, yet sometimes will act against his best interest? I realize at least when I first started representing Drew, that he's a unique type of individual. He has a lot of years in law enforcement. So he knows a lot more about the system than most, and criminal justice than a lot of defendants, and a lot of lawyers for that matter. He certainly doesn't make it easier, but he deserves, as vigorous a defense as I can give him, no matter how strange or goofy he may act.
Yeah.
I've adjusted my style of the defense to try to fit as best I could, to try to fit his personality and what he keeps doing. Sometimes you got to go with the flow, but the clients, like I say, the lawyer gives advice. The client is the one who makes a decision whether or not to accept it. So far, we've been pretty lucky with Drew. We were able to defeat that gun charge, and so far, he hasn't been charged with anything in cases where there's been an investigation. And I think that I still believe, from what I've been hearing lately, that there still will be no charge. So, but representing somebody who doesn't follow your advice clearly is not the easiest thing in the world to do. I'd much rather have a client who just was lockstep with what I told him, but that's just, we don't live in that type of perfect world.
Okay, Joe Tacopina, your client is all over the cable news shows. It must drive you crazy.
Yeah, it does. I mean, Ben, I don't want to really make this the Ron Sanders load interview.
Right.
I did one with Greta the other night only to sort of denounce what I thought was an unbelievably surprising, because of who Greta is and how much I respect her, unbelievably surprising ratings grab, quite frankly, that amounted really to nothing. But that kind of stuff, Dana, it's upsetting. The system really, it's not a game, and I don't have much tolerance for that. I mean, I've actually let go clients on big cases that if they're not going to follow my advice, then I really don't want to be tied to them. And you have to be, you have to be sometimes militant about that, because you're going to wind up representing someone who, if they're not going to follow your advice, you're really not doing them any you know, service, and you're not doing yourself any service, and you know, you have to really, that's a tough consideration. I mean, especially in this day and age, Dana. I mean, with the media, you know, and the cable networks, and 24-hour, you know, information highway we have going on now, it's really really have to be careful. I mean, I'm in a high profile case right now in New York City on trial. And, you know, it's amazing the stuff that gets in and out on the media, and, you know, things that are not, you know, suitable for the well of a courtroom, but somehow make it into tabloids and become sort of part of your battle.
Yeah, absolutely. Mark Garagos, you still with us?
No, I think he left. Then I heard the click.
Oh, did he? Okay, he thought maybe he'd lose his signal. I'll go to Robin Sachs. The high-profile cases that... you see, and obviously you can't talk about any that you're working on in L.A. County, but these types of cases, from the DA's perspective, all of a sudden the suspect is all over the news media. Everyone is hating them. The news media is trying to, you know, investigate the case, even though they're not law enforcement. As a DA, you must just be sitting back smiling.
Sometimes. Sometimes you can, and sometimes not. The, you know, information works both ways, and as you know, I do most of my work is in child sexual assault prosecution, and the results of a case being in the media for the victim, where there's a lot of publicity, can be devastating, particularly when there's a sexual assault that happened at a school where all of a sudden, you know, it becomes a he said, she said in the media, and my office has very strict, and many prosecutors' offices do and should have very strict guidelines on what we're allowed to say, and basically we're limited to only what is available in terms of public records. So in some ways we sit back and grin depending on what they say, and other times you want to jump out of your seat and say, listen, I have all this evidence. This is what I have on this case. If you only knew it was in my file, there wouldn't be a question. So it can cut both ways. I've said this to you many times. I so much rather comment on other people's cases than see my own case on television.
You know, and I think that's a good question for Joe Tacopina, because he's done both. He comes on to talk about the case that he's representing, plus he has been a talking head. I don't like that term. How do you handle both, Joe?
Yeah, Robin's right. I mean, you know, I was ABC News' legal correspondent for GMA for about 2 years, and it really is nice to sit back in Monday morning quarterback, in the armchair quarterback, and talk about, you know, legal strategies. And really, what you really should be doing, if you're good at being a legal analyst, is not, you know, second-guessing people, but really trying to explain to the public at large what's going on in that regard. Obviously, when you're sitting there as a proponent or, you know, arguing for your client, it's different. You're an advocate again. And you know, obviously, I'm comfortable in that setting. But it is really much, much easier to sit there as a, you know, what's called a talking head for a second, or a pundit, or whatever you want to call it, and really just explain the system and analyze the ongoings. The one thing I will tell you, having been on both sides, Dana, it's maddening, you know, and it's funny because, I guess, you know, it's a little hypocritical, too, on my part, but it's maddening to sit there, you know, representing someone and turning on the TV and seeing, you know, three other lawyers who know nothing about the case talking about the case as if they know something about the case, and your client, and you're like, you know, you guys are idiots. But then you know, there I am 2 weeks later talking about someone else's case. So I fall into that category.
Public has a right to know.
Yeah.
Well, that's how I try and justify it, exactly. And that also, by the way, seriously though, Dana, that's when, you know, when I'm an analyst, I do try and stay away from judging one side or the other. You know, when I'm prosecution and defense, because you really just want to try and sort of at least bring perspective, nothing else.
We got about 4 minutes left. We have Joe Tacopina. Mark Garagos was here, but to get your plane. And Joel Brodsky is here. Joel, you've never seen that. Other people talking about your case, and then
no,
you
I
having
don't
to come.
But the what it's interesting, and I think both Joe and Robin can verify this. The amount of pressure that the media brings, the way they chase after your client, chase after even the lawyers, stake out, telephone calls, dinners, you know, sending these what I'll call these young booker girls, they're bookers, and over to their house, at all different times, just to try to get, you know, a couple minutes of TV. I saw what happened with Joe's client. Vandersloot. And Greta, I think, flew to Thailand, if I'm not incorrect, to do that interview. And even, I think, paid license, what they call a licensing fee, some money.
Oh, it's called licensing.
Yeah, licensing, yeah, right. It's paying for the interview.
Okay.
Anyway, call it. There's a tremendous amount of pressure, and I really think that the way that they pursue this, it adds a dynamic to the criminal justice system that's, you know, just starting. It's something that's, you know, 24-hour, you know, people are making a lot of money, and there's a lot of investment in keeping these news shows on, these crime-driven news shows, true crime news shows. People are making a lot of money, and the more money is being made, the more pressure that's going to be brought, and the competition is it's only going to get worse, and there's going to be more competition, and I think less scrupulous and less ethical tactics are going to be brought to bear, and I really think it's going to have a negative impact on the criminal justice system. I don't know how we can curtail it given the First Amendment, but it's going to be a problem. It's going to be a problem that we're going to have to deal with.
Last question. I know you guys are busy, and I appreciate your time. Is there such a thing, Joe Tacopina and Joel Brodsky, we'll start with Joe, as a fair trial when you have such a high-profile client as what you have?
It's tough, Dana. It's tough. I mean, it really is. You have to spend an awful lot of time, you know, really with that jury and trying to weed out the people who have, you know, come in there with predisposed beliefs. I mean, and that is the toughest part of those trials. It's the thing that keeps you awake most at night. You know, with the Brancato case I'm on trial with now in New York and the Bronx here, you know, I went through, we spent more time so far in jury selection than we have on the trial because there are so many people that have read and, you know, just the formed opinions, and yeah, that is absolutely the hardest part. But I will say this: if you front it with the jury, and you know, you don't ignore the pink elephant sitting in the courtroom, and just, you know, get it out there, and really charge this jury with the awesome responsibility of following their oaths and really evaluating the case on the evidence and the law, and not on, you know, with some pundit or with some, you know, blog or some, you know, internet site writes about a case, I think you could really rally that jury to take that responsibility very seriously and put aside everything that they've heard and read. And, you know, if that happens, then I think you're in the best position you could be in what's otherwise a very, very difficult situation.
Joel Brodsky?
Yeah, Joe's absolutely correct. It doesn't mean you can't get a fair trial. It means you have to work a hell of a lot harder to get one. And in the gun case that fortunately didn't go forward with Drew, we had scheduled 2 weeks for jury selection and 4 days for trial. It takes a tremendous amount of work to get past this publicity, but If you have a good judge and a good prosecutor and you work hard, you can be done. It's just necessary. It's unfortunately unnecessary amount of effort, but it can be done. You just got to put a lot of work into it.
Listen, I appreciate you guys coming on. Robin, I will get back to you because I want to bring you on for the next segment. I hope we can do this again. It's just a way, you know, I'm not going to sit here and browbeat you and trying to get you to say your client's guilty because you're not going to do that. It's a way to let the public know that we've got a pretty good system and it works the way it is. And like I say, I'd sit down and have a beer with any one of you anytime. Thanks for joining me.
Okay, guys.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Dana.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye. All right, that's Mark Garagos. We had to lose Mark because he was on an airplane flight. Of course, you know Mark is representing the convicted murderer, Scott Peterson. You know Joel Brodsky is representing the former Bolingbrook police officer, Drew Peterson. Joe Tacopina representing Joran Vandersloot and ADA Robin Sachs from Los Angeles County. We're going to take a break and we're going to come back with Robin Sachs and Melody Schmidt. Melody Schmidt is the mother of Joshua Whittier. She's going to talk about her son's death. And is Joshua's death Florida's best kept secret? We'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
And now, more of the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
Okay, we're back. In this segment, we're going to talk about the death of Joshua Whittier. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And on the line with me is Melody Schmidt, who is Joshua's mom, and Robin Sachs, ADA from Los Angeles County. She was with us on the last segment. And I encourage you to check out this webpage, America's Watching www.joshua_Whittier, and that Whittier is spelt W-H-I-T-T-I-E-R, and that's .html. Welcome to Show Melody.
Thank you very much.
When we talk about your son, sadly, he died February 18th, 2007, and the webpage I'm looking at here says, was Joshua Whittier killed February 18th, 2007. Tell me about your son and, sadly, his death.
Josh had turned 21. He had been in Miami putting together a modeling portfolio with Ford Models. He'd been down there for 3 weeks. He came home following weekend. He finally had some money because he got a second paycheck, two paychecks from his construction job that they owed him. And it was Mardi Gras weekend, and he hadn't seen his friends for 3 weeks, so they were going to have a good time celebrating his 21st birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And he was out at the beach all day, and there's only one restaurant and one bar in that area, so they watched the parade, and then they went to the restaurant, and then later on they went to the bar, and just were having a good time. I think he was with about four or five other people, and we have witnesses of people who he was saying who he was with. And do you want me to continue what we believe happened to Josh?
Yeah, please. Okay. We might as well get right into the events surrounding and what every parent dreads is the call to from the police department that you've lost a loved one.
Yeah. Unbelievable. They were having a good time. Josh left the bar, and he was treating people. A couple times people stated in the police reports, Josh had a lot of money that night. And he went outside around 1:30.
Where would he have got the money from?
His two paychecks.
Okay.
That were owed him.
Okay.
From previous work that week, and then even before he'd gone to Miami, they had owed him money.
Okay.
But he had about $900 on him that day.
All right.
They left the bar around 1:30, and about 3:30, the lady was delivering newspapers, ran into two people running out from under the bar and scared the crap out of her and her husband. And later on, we had her ID who these people were, and they were the individuals that were with Josh. About 6:30, his body was found. I was not contacted until that Sunday night is when I found out what had happened. I was wondering where Josh was, trying to find out, had anybody talked to him? And he was right along the edge of the water. I have found out a pastor is the one who saw my son and called the police, and he told me Josh didn't look like he'd been in the water. He was not wet when they came. Another man was there when the police showed up, and he told me the same thing. Josh's left hand looked like it was sitting in the water, and it was a little bit, I don't know what the word is you use when your hand just gets wet and soggy, I guess.
Okay.
But the rest of him, no. His shirt was up over his head. Everything was full of sand, his pockets, everything. His phone turned on, though, which shouldn't have worked had it been in the water for any length of time.
Okay.
Later on, we discovered Josh had blood stains on the outside of his pants that we had tested, the medical examiner and the police weren't even aware of.
And when you had those blood stains tested, your son's blood?
We don't know whose blood it is. We have not done DNA, but we know that it is on the outside of the pants.
Okay, but you had met...
It would be Josh's. And the other thing to that is, it would have washed out if he'd been in the water any length of time.
You had mentioned, though, that you had it tested, or did I misunderstand you?
We had it tested to find out where the blood was coming from.
Oh, I see.
Or the outside.
Okay, no, I understand.
But it was definitely from the outside.
Okay, and you say the police hadn't or didn't notice that?
They did not know it was there, the medical examiner either.
Okay.
David Craig pointed it out, and then Dr. Berklin, who both of those people have helped me immensely.
Okay.
Dr. Berklin had it tested by an FBI specialist.
Okay. Now, again, I don't want to bring up bad memories for you, but, it's probably a parent's worst nightmare to have to go and identify their child at a morgue once they've died. You had to do that, obviously. Take us back.
I didn't go to the morgue, Dana. I went to the police station, and they showed photos.
Photographs. Okay. Same thing.
I never did look at Josh's body. I felt like I wanted to remember Josh the way he was.
Well, regardless, when you have to identify your child and they've passed, whether it's in a morgue or through a photograph or a lot do them by video now, it has to be tragic. What have the police told you about... Hello? Are you still there?
I am still
here.
Okay.
So I can barely hear you.
Okay. No, sorry. I'll get to you in a second, Robin. You can't hear me or you can't hear the guest?
No, I can't. I can barely hear Melody.
Okay. If you could speak up a little bit, Melody.
Sure, I can do that.
Okay. What have the police told you as far as this investigation goes?
They're looking at it as I'm an over-emotional grieving mother, and they'll look into some things that I requested. They closed the case, and they never treated it as a homicide, which I've been told that is incorrect behavior. They should always look at it as a homicide until proven otherwise. It was not treated that way.
Okay.
They closed the case. I got upset, got the state attorney, started bothering them. They reopened the case, didn't do a lot. Then they shut it down again. Well, I kept complaining. And we got it reopened, and I had to request DNA, which I believe they've done, but they are not telling me any results. I asked for photo lineups to be done. I asked for certain people to be questioned, and I asked for phone records to be checked on certain people who were with my son that night. And the state attorney's assistant's telling me he doesn't understand what the phone record's going to tell me.
Yeah, let's go to Robin Sachs, ADA from Los Angeles County. I don't like it when law enforcement come back and say they have an emotional grieving mother. Well, what do they expect when her child has died, and the circumstances are questionable? But let's get into the responsibility of the state's attorney, the police department. You know, the family's not happy with the investigation. What did they do? Can they go to another law enforcement agency to follow up, or how do they handle that?
Listen, there is no doubt that in a case, it's always very, very, very difficult personally. And this is, you know, Robin speaking as Robin, not as a prosecutor, but as a mom, as a human being. When you're involved in a case and you just don't know if you have enough to file the criminal charges.
Yep.
Now, there's a big difference in filing a case and continuing an investigation. The problem that I have here is that if everything that we're hearing in terms of what Melody's saying, in terms of facts of pointing to, it certainly has me scratching my head as to why is this case closed? I can't figure that part out. And the thing that I find is, why have we not heard anything from Florida about this? I mean, Florida hasn't exactly been quiet on other cases, as we know.
No, that's for sure.
So why don't you know, let's hear what they got and what their position is. That would just kind of be able to put some ease into perspective into being able to understand this, because it does appear to be hugely, hugely unjust, not knowing how is it with what seems to be a lot of evidence. Not being dealt with, but at the same time, there's always two sides to the story, and I just haven't felt that I really have my hands around what their exact position is. I think that, when you're looking at a case from a prosecutor's point of view, we're looking at, can we prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt? And I can understand reasons that may be very difficult to, you know, cases where you actually believe everything, but you just, you know, have issues with corroboration or whatever. You see that in sexual assault and have to tell victims that we're not filing charges. That's different than closing an investigation. So this is, I commend the work of Melody in terms of going through, you know, really kind of going through the whole file and, you know, really conducting an investigation. I'm just kind of surprised that a case where there was a death that happened only in 2007, which is really not that long ago in the life of a homicide investigation. I mean, we've just had, just talked about Natalie Holloway and how long has that investigation continued on. why isn't it that this is not being at least have some sort of closure as to what happened?
Well, families deserve answers, and Melody Schmidt is here. She's talking about the death of her son, Joshua Whittier, and I want to remind you again to go to the webpage americaswatching.org/Joshua_Whittier. Whittier is spelled W-H-I-T-T-I-E-R. Melody, has the media been able to help you bring some attention to your case? Obviously, you're on this program, and you've been on Robbins and others, but has the media, local media, been able to put some pressure on the authorities there?
The local media is very small there. I was told I needed an investigative reporter, and it's so small there, I couldn't get it to go any further. I talked to a person in Tallahassee where the governor is, and he never picked it up either. So I'm trying to get national coverage, hopefully with you guys' help. Susan's been wonderful, too, on Justice Interrupted. Hopefully we can get this opened up. And the first thing that the sheriff told me is he didn't want the media involved. And I said, I'm sorry, sir, I can't agree to that, because that's who's been helping me with any of this. And I have found some of the media to be, you know, very fair in reporting, and some of it to be very unfair, which is probably very normal.
Well, it's certainly obvious that you and your family deserve answers in this case, and I want to share a couple of lines on the bottom of the webpage. It says in big red letters, is there justice in the system, or just us in the system? And I think that's so important. Melody Schmidt, thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Dana, for having me.
Okay, and Robin Sachs, thank you. We'll talk soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, that's a case that's... Is it Florida's best-kept secret? Is it the unfortunate death of a young man? Or is it a homicide? They definitely deserve a proper investigation. And check out the webpage. It's in our show notes. And, you know, look at these things, because you have to wonder how many cases like this are going with... without proper investigation. Is it a training issue for the police? Is it just a quick rush to judgment? Definitely the family needs some answers in this case, no matter what the cause. We're going to take a break. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name is Dana Pretzer, and we're going to come back with an update on the Natalie Holloway investigation, what's been going on there lately. Jossie Manser, the managing editor of Diario, will be here to tell you some things that's going on in that island that we just can't seem to stop talking about. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, here's your host, Dana Pretzer.
In our continuing coverage of the disappearance of Alabama teenager Natalie Holloway and the most recent revelations out of Aruba from Justice Minister Rudy Cruz that former police official Vander Straaten was aware of what was going on and helped cover it up because he was friends with Paul Vandersloot. I thought I'd go to the best source in Aruba for information, the managing editor of the REO, Jossie Manser. Hi, Jossie.
Hi.
Last time we talked a couple of weeks back, I believe, this hadn't come out yet, although you and I talked about this several years ago, actually, the cover-up of Paulus being friends with police officials. Some of this really isn't all that new, is it?
No, it is, and I remember us talking about it. We went into a lot of details, and we knew there was a link between the two men. They worked together on many cases, one as a police officer and the other one as a prosecutor. And that was, he worked in the prosecution department.
And we're talking about Paulus when he worked
about Paulus, yes.
Right. Now, the most recent revelations coming out of Aruba from Justice Minister Cruz is it seems like it's a lot of finger-pointing. People are starting to blame each other for the failure into this investigation. Am I wrong when I say that?
No, you are absolutely correct. Because when they're looking at what's happening now with Aruba, all the negative publicity that's going on, they realized that they should have done their jobs better, both the government and the police. And now, that's finger-pointing. But all this came about because Vander Straaten criticized a branch that is not exactly the police, but doesn't belong exactly to the police corps, but it's a part, which is the Coast Guard of Aruba, which is a baby of the Minister of Justice. And because he had some negative remarks about it, then Rudy Cruz decided that, well, it's about time for him to come open, and he accused and blamed Van der Staten for things having gone wrong with the case from the beginning.
What is Van der Straten doing today?
I think he's not doing anything now. I know that from Aruba he went to Bonaire. He was the chief of police in Bonaire for quite a while, a couple of years. And then I think he came back to Aruba and he's just living here.
I'm just curious if he has responded to these criticisms from Rudy Cruz.
Knowing him, I'm sure he will.
Have you spoken to him?
No, I haven't, but I will. On Monday, I'll contact him and go over all of this with him. Because these accusations are serious, no? Rudy Cruz was his boss because the police cause of Aruba resorts under the Minister of Justice. He's responsible for them.
Some of the allegations that are coming out is that Van der Straten would not or acted slowly when it came to the arrest of Joran because he couldn't do that to his godson. Or did I understand that wrong?
No, that is correct also. No. Somebody, he said this in the presence of a few people, he said, how am I going to arrest the son of my best friend? That's exactly what he said, according to these sources. That's come public now. It's public knowledge now that Van der Straten at one point or another in the beginning of the case made that expression, yes.
When you speak to Van der Straten on Monday, I'm sure you'll be asking the same questions that many of us would like to ask him. But one of the most important questions, because there's so much speculation out there, Jossie, is that could this case have been solved in the first few days? Or the ultimate question, was this case solved in the first few days and it's just a complete cover-up right from front to back?
I don't know whether it was properly solved in the first few, but they knew precisely who were involved. Does the police know exactly what the three suspects did with Natalie? Joran took her to the beach, etc. You remember there was also a statement by Joran that he knew where Deepak had buried the girl. So the demise of the girl starts very early in this case. So that's why I can't understand why people come up now with this theory that she was sold into slavery, into sex slavery, into Latin America.
Do you believe that theory? I think that Joran himself admitted what he did with Natalie when he was recorded in the DeVries interview. However, now Greta Van Susteren has come forward with this new slavery recording, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are.
I believe what he said to Van Ames and the DeVries recording comes closer to the truth by far than what he said in the interview with Greta Van Susteren with regards to having sold her to a man interested in taking her to Venezuela or Colombia and putting her to work in this sex industry that they have.
Now,
I think that's closer to the truth.
The allegations of her being sold into sex slavery were investigated early on in this case, were they not?
They were. And, you know, I've been busy in journalism in Aruba for over 30 years. I still have to learn about one case that somebody that disappeared was sold, or that they found out with evidence that she was sold into this sex slavery trade. It just doesn't click with me. I'm not aware of that, and I think I'm aware of practically everything that goes on this island.
Paulus van der Sloot has been a person of interest in this case right from day one. Again, you and I have talked about that years ago. It sure looked like him sitting in the picture beside Natalie in the casino. Now, with the allegations of the Justice Minister pointing fingers at van der Straten and his friendship with Paulus, and what happened with Joran and Greta Van Susteren, where there's this alleged tape of Paulus saying it's wrong to sell someone, has Paulus van der Sloot gone underground?
We don't hear anything about him. I mean, both he and the Kalpu brothers are dead silent now. There's not a peep coming out of them.
What kind of reaction have the people of Aruba given, and that includes the justice minister, the police, whoever, to the recent interview of Joran and Greta Van Susteren?
Fox doesn't come over with the cable service that we have here, so many people don't have that service and couldn't have watched it. But those people that do have it via big satellites, big dishes, are very interested in this, but they when I spoke to them also, the majority of the opinion, I think 99%, is that this guy is lying again. Now, my take on this is this. I think that what Joran is doing is he's building up a structure around him of lying, so that in case he goes to court, the judge will have a very hard time deciding between truth and lies, because this guy, every story that he tells, he comes back and says, nah, I lied, and I lied, and I lied. So he's building his future defense on that, that he's a chronic liar.
You and I have discussed Hans Moss before and our disappointment and his lack of caring, I'm going to say, as far as this case goes. It seems like he's just totally disinterested. What is he saying now with this recent information? And we're hearing that he's not very happy with the Holloway family lawyer, John Q. Kelly, and Greta Van Susteren.
No, he isn't, but he's not saying anything either. He just keeps quiet. He doesn't want to cooperate. He didn't send for the recordings that Greta offered him. And the only thing that we hear from the Open Bar Ministerio as the Ministry of Justice is that they plan to either take Joran to court or whomever they think are suspects by the end of December or the end of January. Now they have extended it to the end of January. And I think that they're playing for a little time for this to go under again, not so much attention to come up, and then just close the case. Easier for them.
Yeah, that part is so unfortunate. But there are new witnesses that have come forward, or I should say old witnesses that have come forward that have implicated Joran and Paulus. Let's talk about that.
Yes, there are. There is one witness that came forward that went to the U.S. and took some polygraph tests and with a lot of success. I mean, they proved that what he was saying was the truth. I mean, he says very distinctly that he saw Joran that early morning that Natalie disappeared, walking by a pond with his clothes drenched in mud, and that afterward he saw him again in a car with his father driving the car. So the big mystery that we had is who took Joran home or how did he get home becomes clearer with this statement. His father picked him up and took him home.
I'm going to use the term corruption, Jossie. How deep does that go when it comes to this investigation? Obviously, nobody has wanted to do anything. They've covered it up to try and protect friends. I'm very curious to see what Van der Straten tells you on Monday. But how corrupt are these people?
You know, very, very corrupt. If we go by the government alone, I mean, the corruption that goes on here is flagrant. It's beyond any imagining. Something horrible.
Have you spoken to Beth or Dave Holloway lately?
As a matter of fact, I spoke to Dave today. He called me today to find out some kind of information that he needed. Yes, I do keep contacts with him.
And how is the family reacting to all this information? Of course, anyone would want the smallest chance that their child may still be alive, although in peril if she was still alive. But when you look at the evidence and you look at reality, I think even Beth Holloway has said that she does not believe that. What kind of sense were you getting from Dave when you spoke to him about this new information?
That he has the same opinion that I do, that the latest declarations or statements of Joran are just not believable. That, like most of the people, the FBI, the police, and some people within the prosecution have believed all along that she is no longer with us. I mean, that she's no longer alive. I get the sense that they keep on working, you know, they're doing their job. I mean, the family is all out to get some kind of a solution and closure to this case. And I have the feeling from Dave that they don't believe these latest histories or theories that have come forward.
It is so difficult to believe what he has to say, yet it is so important to keep the story alive, and Greta should be complimented for keeping the story alive, although I do have problems with paying Joran van der Sloot for anything because he just likes to take advantage of people. Jossie Mansour, managing editor of Diario, you plan on speaking to the former police official van der Straten on Monday. Do you think I'm going to throw this out to you right now, that Vander Stratton would be willing to come on my program and have free reign. Basically, I would let him speak, and he can defend himself if that is what he wants to do.
Well, I'll sure make a pitch for it. I'll try to convince him, but it will be up to him whether he will accept or not. But I will make it a point to discuss that point with him, yes.
You know me, Jossie. I would be more than willing to bring him on the air and let him refute any claims that have been made against him, and we will stay in touch. Thanks, Jossie.
Okay, thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Jossie Mansour from Aruba. And yeah, Mr. Vander Stratton, if you want to come on my program, I will open the mic up for you and allow you to have free rein and discuss what you think went wrong with the investigation into Natalie Holloway. And were you trying to protect your friend by acting slowly? Is there corruption that you would like to talk about? We shall see. My name is Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. And we are back, and you know, it's always nice to have Jossie Mansour on the air to talk about what's going on in Aruba, because there's so many different versions of things, but they all tie into the same thing. Call it corruption, collusion, you name it. I think there are more answers should come from the government over there and the prosecutors, and like I say, justice is served in many different ways. Will we get justice for Natalie? Oh, hopefully, that's for sure. We're going to put on a caller. Hi, caller.
Hey, Dana. How are you this evening?
I'm good. Just a second here. I'm turning up the knob. Yeah, it is Red from Scared Monkeys, the top banana. You and I and Joe Tacopina are going for a beer after the show.
is Joe buying?
Yeah, Joe's buying, yeah, for sure. Anyway, listen, I want to get your thoughts first before and maybe that's why you're calling in. The purpose of, and I know you emailed me earlier on today, and I'd actually thought about this last week when I started planning the show, is I knew that OJ was going to be sentenced today. And I thought, what a neat topic for a show. Is I couldn't get Yale Galanter, although I tried, to come on.
He's probably a little busy today.
Yeah, he is. He's a little busy. But I wanted to get someone. In fact, I was very close to getting one of OJ's other attorneys on the program, but that's besides the point, to come on and talk about having a high-profile client like that, and what do you do? Now, you know, I don't think picking Drew Peterson, Scott Peterson, and Joran Vandersloot, that I could have picked three more despised people in the media today and by the public today. And I thought I'd bring on their attorneys to not talk about their cases in particular, but talk about how they handle a case like that. Was I wrong to do that? I thought it was a pretty good idea.
No, I mean... For all the faults that our justice system has, and you know, we hear about the ones that go wrong. We don't see the many that actually go right, even though the defense attorneys think that they're always wronged because their clients are always innocent. But it's an interesting premise, and I mean, for the most part, you know, I believe hell froze over today because to get Joe Tacopina to come on Scared Monkeys Radio was kind of comical, to say the least. I had to take a look at my email several times when I saw that come across the wire to make sure whether I read it right or not. I figured, you know, Joe was suing us for something.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, that being said, there is a place. I mean, obviously, a person is supposed to get the best defense that they possibly can. And the only problem I really have with some of this, Dana, is I think in many cases, I don't know if justice is being served. And when I shouldn't even say justice being served. I should say the rich are getting away with murder, I guess for a better term. These high-profile cases that you're referring to, you know, just didn't become high-profile for the hell of it. Their clients had a lot to do with it. And I don't think that the the defense attorneys in several of these cases kind of acknowledge that.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you, and that wasn't really the road that I wanted to go down tonight. I wanted to try, and I know it's impossible, because, hey, I've been in the system a long time. I know a lot of defense attorneys. I've been grilled by them and accused of things and all sorts of stuff, but I sit down and talk with them after. But that, I'm aware of the system. I wanted to talk to them about how they handle it. And these attorneys, in fact, one that was on tonight was talking to me off air about a lawsuit that he's involved in right now, where he's helping a nonprofit organization sue a big company. Now, does that mean that he's a good guy helping the small guy, yet he can help the bad guy when it, you know, it's the whole thing about the system. And yeah, the system seems, I had an email from a person here today saying that I think it was they would never let their child become a lawyer because words to the effect that they would have to go after the victim and try and protect the accused. Anyway, words to that effect, and I understand that. But it's the fact that these guys, all three of them, love them or hate them, are just guys. And I talked to them quite lengthy off air, and I have a little different opinion of some of them right now, and that's an opinion I'm going to keep to myself because I don't want to get slaughtered on air. But I'm going to do more shows with actually all three of them in time, and I think it will bring good things to Scared Monkeys Radio. In fact, it may bring things to the type of programming that we do, Red, that those in the mainstream media can't do because we let them speak here, and that was what that was about.
Well, and I agree with you 100% when it comes to that, Dana. I mean, I don't like the shouting back and forth. I think it's senseless. However, I do like debate.
Yep.
Nobody probably is more of a free speech person than myself. And the only caveat I would put with what you're saying, and I agree with the programming. I think it's a great idea. I have personal opinions myself because I've dealt with these with one in particular that I've been on TV shows with Joe. And when he was just a pundit, he acted one way. When he became Jarn Vandersloot's attorney, he became quite something different. And then he refused to go on shows with me because he didn't want to debate the topics, because he didn't want to go up against somebody who knew the subject matter better than him.
At least they all said, though, that they would much sooner talk about somebody else's case than their own case. And yet,
well, and that's probably the case because, I mean, let's think about it. I mean, they're an attorney. How much are they really supposed to talk about their own case?
Not supposed to.
Without damaging their
exactly.
own case.
Yep.
And, you know, Joe Tacopino had made a comment that, you know, he has let clients go who would not listen. And well, I mean, if I'm really to believe that, he would have been letting Jarn Vandersloot go probably week one into his defense of him,
right.
Because all the guy has done is just nonstop talk. I mean, he has never once listened to his parents, to his lawyers, to anybody, and for that we can probably thank him, because he's been a one man wrecking crew of himself. And you know, for someone to say, you know, I'm probably one of the few cases where I will actually defend the media. To Greta's defense, she's not the one who contacted Jarn to do this interview. It was him.
Yep.
So, I mean, in this day and age, the media getting a phone call from someone like that, I mean, that's like getting a phone call from OJ, from getting a phone call from Charles Manson, from getting a, you know, they're going to do the story.
Yeah, but...
And, so it's not the media's fault in that case. It's the client's fault in that case for putting themselves out there like that. So, we can talk about, you know, what a defense attorney is supposed to do for the client and how the legal system is supposed to work, but it's a two-way street. You can't just say that you know, they're supposed to defend their client to the utmost, and then everyone else is evil for trying to talk about it. Because trust me, in this day and age, you know, between the internet, between 24/7 news, I mean, how can you not know about the case? And I mean, for better or for worse, I guess I have a I literally have a get out of jail free card for ever serving on a jury by having an opinionated blog on criminals.
Yeah, that's true. Listen, we're down to a couple of minutes, and I want to get your thoughts on, and I made the invitation very clear, and we're going to work on it to bring Jan van der Straaten on this program and have him defend himself. We're going to try it. I think it's important to see, and maybe we can, maybe this is something that can be done that others can't do, because, you know, all this talk, talk about corruption and all this talk about collusion, and hey, I'm the biggest one to agree with everyone on this. The whole thing is that there's still no justice for Natalie. It's just a bunch of talk right now, and I think what needs to be done, and whether it's here, there, or anywhere, Greta or whoever, is some of these higher-ups need to be given a chance to explain themselves, because they will eventually. What they're going to say, or are they going to lie about it, I don't know, but I've thrown out that invitation to them. We'll see what happens.
Well, and I would also say, Dana, to add Rudy Cruz to that mix.
Yep.
I, believe it or not, my family, were actually very good friends with the Cruz family back in the day. So I've actually met Rudy many, many years ago in the 90s. And we're going to try to see if he can't come on. And
yep.
Unfortunately, 3.5 years late, I mean, he probably was 3.5 years late in his comments.
That's true.
They put this stuff off as breaking news.
Yeah, it's old stuff.
Corruption in Aruba. When I think you, me, and the rest of the intelligent world was claiming this from day one.
We talked about this 3.5 years ago.
I talked about it probably day three or day four.
Sure.
into this case because of having insight into what Aruba was all about and how they conducted business. And I had told Beth and Dave way a long time ago what to expect. And little by little, it's exactly what happened along the way of the cover-up. So when suddenly two black security guards were fingered as the usual suspects, it became, that was just it was just icing on the cake as to what was predicted as to what would happen. But when you look at this thing in whole, Dana, I mean, here it is, 3.5 years later, and through no fault of the family, and in reality, they haven't. It isn't the family that's, it isn't Beth or Dave that have actually pushed this case.
Mm-hmm.
It's Joran van der Sloot not being able to stay out of trouble.
Yep.
I mean, it's absolutely amazing if you think about it, and just the sociopathic tendencies that this person has to constantly be in the spotlight, constantly do wrong. And I mean, if it doesn't reek of O.J. Simpson, I don't know what it does. But I mean, I think I had emailed you this, and granted, I know that, Joe Tacopino isn't gonna go on a show with me and say this back and forth because he can't. Could he say it on an off the record phone call? Maybe to yourself or to me. But I would really say, at what point? Because he's actually now called his client sick.
Yep.
And a sociopath.
I heard that. Yep.
And you really have to wonder, Dana. Do we really think Joran is sick now and a sociopath now? Or was he sick and a sociopath 3.5 years ago? And all he's done is lied along the way. And Paulus van der Sloot lied along the way, along with the cover-ups, to their attorneys.
Yep.
I mean, can Joe Tacopino, obviously, can he look me in the face and say to me at this point, oh, my client has told me the truth every inch of the way, and I believe he's 100% innocent? No. I mean, is he going to say it to me? Sure. If I said, would you bet your children on it? I hardly doubt he would ever even contemplate such a saying. So, you know, you really look at this and can't but say to yourself, the guy's, Joran's been lying all along. He's been fabricating stories all along. Are there bits and pieces of truth in his lies? Oh, there certainly are, because that's another trend and traits of a sociopath.
Yep. No, I couldn't agree more. Anyway, Red, thank you. I think we lost. Are you still there?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Okay, bye. That's Red from Scared Monkeys. And yeah, would an attorney come and tell you right to your face that his client was lying? There's no way in hell that they would do that. That's our system. And if I was the client and my attorney came forward and said that I did it, yet he was trying to get me off because of a technicality, Miranda issue or whatever, there's a lawyer-client privilege, and that lawyer would soon be disbarred. Does it make it right or does it make it wrong? You know, who knows? But it's the system. It's the best system that we have, and we'll keep plugging along, and there will be justice for everyone. It just has to come in certain ways. The best ways through the courts. Other ways justice can be served, too. Anyway, that's it. That's tonight's show. Don't forget our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. We'll see you again real soon.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.